Hey everybody, another week, another parade of cinematic shite. I'm Craig Eastman, coming to you as always from just outside Liverpool. And in sunny Glasgow, it's Scott Morris.
Hello.
And in Ed Gein's conservatory, it's Drew Tavendale.
Hello.
It's a fairly morose bunch this week we've got for you, so we'll crack on and make it as painless as possible for you. Howard Deutsch is, for many people, the director of legendary 80s teen romance Pretty in Pink. One would assume then that those people have never seen, or perhaps been rendered comatose by, such following fare as Getting Even with Dad, Grumpier Old Men, The Odd Couple 2, The Replacements, and The Whole 10 Yards. On the face of it then, My Best Friend's Girl, Deutsch's latest directorial effort, should be a trailblazing comedic masterpiece. Scott, am I wrong or am I spectacularly wrong?
You are quite spectacularly wrong in ways you cannot possibly comprehend. This film is total fucking drivel and I have no wish to discuss it.
Drew, would you like to expand on that incisive comment?
Not an awful lot. It's incredibly dull. It's simply not funny. And Jason Biggs is a non-entity. Let's not spend too long, but Jason Biggs is a non-entity, so you don't care about him. Dane Cook, while reasonably likable, isn't given anything worthwhile to say. Kate Hudson's deeply unlikable, and the whole film's incredibly unfunny and astonishingly dull. Let's move on.
Yeah, so much so we're not even going to tell you what it's about. So, Howard Deutsch, fuck off. Jason Statham has twice before entertained us as Frank Martin, and I do use the word entertained with some reservation. And The Transporter 3 sees him return yet again as a dangerous driver for hire, who always seems to end up taking off his shirt. Built on a solid foundation of hot women, fast cars, big explosions, daft stunts and an oddly homoerotic undercurrent, the series this time ups the ante by supplementing Martin's human escort antics with an electronic explosive wristband which will detonate if he is separated from his beloved wheels. How much excitement can you handle? Drew, for me, the first Transporter film was of mild interest and was oddly entertaining in a childish way. I thought the second one was bab. Does the law of diminishing returns continue with three?
Yes, well, I thought the first film was slightly worse than you thought it. I thought the second film was worse than that. And can you guess where I'm going with this?
Oh, is it the very bottom of an abysmal pit of shitness?
Oh, it is. Presumably in the preparation for this film, somebody has thought, what is it the Transporter series is missing? And they've come up with the obvious answer of character development. Quite what they expected to achieve by taking a sequel to an already poor action film and putting in less action and more character is utterly, utterly beyond me.
Surely there wasn't any more room for character development after the first two films, though. What a yes. Complex study of Frank Martin those were.
I liked his pectorals.
They seem to have decided that they need to have character development and a love story for Frank Martin, and presumably because the suggestion was that he was gay. And the only thing I'd like to say in response to that is, so what? The film was about driving fast.
People can't drive cars, Drew.
The film was about driving fast and beating people up, and I can't understand what sexual orientation had to do with that, but it's just such a dull and pointless and fatally flawed film. The whole premise is flawed, and it's frankly moronic. We have our Frank Martin employed as the best driver in Europe, it seems, to transport precious cargo across Europe, presumably because his driving skills will be needed, right? But the person who's employed him has a hand in a power an army of people across the continent able to swiftly get to any given place, including to intercept Frank at several moments during the film, thereby rendering needless Frank's participation at all, which is a strange way to set about plotting your film.
There's probably no percentage you'd actually talking about the plot in this film, because we'll be here
because it isn't one.
That's actually not a problem. You don't go and watch a Transporter film for its plot. You go and watch it to see silly chase scenes and silly kung fu and silly shootouts.
No, now, because if you have any sense at all, you don't go and see a Transporter film.
I was going to say, you only go off because you can't really be bothered with anything that's going to attach your brain more because you're quite tired on a Saturday night.
Because you can't be bothered with life anymore.
The problem with this is it's got a small amount of silly action and a small amount of silly driving at the start, and it's, to be fair, it's actually not too badly handled. It fits in well enough with the rest of the franchise. It's not terrible, and it's a halfway decent showing from, I don't know how much you'd attribute this to Oliver Megaton, the comic director of it. Or
it's my favourite director purely on the basis of his name.
It is, although I suspect most of the plaudits should really go to Corey Ewan, who's back doing the chop socky choreography. But then you get that, and then for some reason there's this grinding to a halt as it puts this crappy half-hour love story between two people that can't act and one person who you just want to slap the freckles off because she's so fucking irritating. And then it tries to start up again, and by that point everyone's like, eh, I can't be bothered, and going to the toilet and do something far more fun. It is just crucially flawed in that respect. It's an action film that stops having action, and it's very silly.
Yeah, there are a couple of sort of quite entertaining scenes, sort of a couple large hand-on-hand combat scenes against multiple opponents that are quite entertainingly handled, including a massive bloke getting smacked in the face by a shovel, which is always good for a laugh. One reasonably entertaining bit where Jason Statham has to chase down a fleeing car on a BMX. But other than that, though, it's just missing action. It seemed, and with the idea of his explosive bracelet not allowing him far away from the car, that has the potential to build tension, but it's utterly squandered, bar the one BMX chase I mentioned. Yeah, it's just a pointless film. It's a deeply, deeply annoying and unlikable woman who seems to, for some reason, have an entirely different personality in every single scene.
I was trying to think of someone in an action-ish franchise more annoying, and the only person I can come up with is Dakota Fanning in War of the Worlds. It's of that level of sort of nuclear irritation, yeah.
Yeah. The one upside is that it was blissfully free of parkour, which is apparently obligatory in action films nowadays, and it didn't have any of that.
Certainly European ones, yeah.
Just, oh, so jaded by that, so that was fortunately missing, but it didn't really make up for the fact the rest of the film is utterly pointless.
I'm going out on a limb here, but at any point does Frank Martin beat some people up whilst taking off his suit jacket and use the suit jacket as a weapon?
Several times. And these were in the hand-to-hand combat scenes I mentioned. It's like, they weren't original, they were just entertaining. But
it's essentially a special move, isn't it? It's like a dragon punch or a fireball.
Yeah.
Take off suit and strangle someone with it.
What you really want is some sort of like real-time interactive version of the transporter where the sort of the crowd all have a little like a D-pad and some buttons.
Oh God, don't make it a quick-time event movie.
Yeah, quick-time event movie. Depend upon the button combination, the most prevalent button combination in the audience, then you get to see Frank Martin pulling off a particular move. Maybe if you buy like a large Coke in the foyer or something, there's a little peel-off panel and it's got a combo underneath it. Cool. Suit jacket slap.
Perhaps it's the basis of a drinking game. The entire film's been made so every time Jason Statham uses his clothing to fight, you have to take a drink.
Yes.
Not sure how well that'll work. The only way to make a transporter film enjoyable is to get very drunk beforehand. So.
Oh, no, wait a minute. You, by your own admission, very much liked the first transporter film. So don't go tarring them all now saying that, oh, it's a transporter film, therefore it's shit, because you liked the first transporter film.
Yeah, I thought it was endearingly stupid.
Yes, did you not enjoy the second as well, though? I thought you said the second one you enjoyed. I'm not taking the mick out of you for it, but...
Not particularly. I mean, I would have said I enjoyed it more than you lot did, but... I couldn't...
Damning with faint praise.
I'm certainly not going to sit here and tell you it is a good film. It is just too silly. I mean, the thing I liked about the first Transporter was it basically took all the kind of standard 80s action movie stuff and turned all the knobs up to 11 and took out the plot. And I'm down with that. Then the next one, they tried to turn the knobs up to 22, and then the knobs sort of broke and fell off in their hands, and they just left looking rather silly, having their knob in their hands. Transporter 3 is, I'm pretty sure it's probably just done on, because it must have been done on a lesser budget than the other two, I've not actually checked that, but it's cheaper to have two characters talking as the sun goes down in the background than it is to stage another car chase. So I'm assuming that this was shoehorned in more as a cost-saving device rather than something that they thought would make it a better film. Still doesn't excuse the fact that it's fucking dire.
It's character development for sun readers, really, isn't it?
Well, it would be if the characters actually developed any.
But they do if you're a sun reader. We'll leave it at that.
Yeah, I'm not sure where you're going with that.
I want you to join in my lambasting of people who read the Sun newspaper who gave Transporter 3 9 out of 10. But that's all right, I'll stand alone. Unlike so many directors, Clint Eastwood's gradual shift towards life behind the camera has been regularly punctuated by outstanding works that border on understated genius. If anything, this trend seems to be intensifying as a Hollywood legend approaches 80, following up his award-baiting Letters from Iwo Jima with another acclaimed effort in the shape of Changeling. It sees Angelina Jolie play frantic mother Christine Collins in the true story of a 1920s Los Angeles woman whose missing son is returned to her by the police in the form of a complete stranger. With the police and child adamant that the correct son has been found, Collins's protestations cause a media backlash that sees her ostracised and eventually fall foul of a self-fulfilling allegation of mental instability. With only a local reverend, played by John Malkovich, for support, can Christine absolve herself of the accusations she faces and find her real son? Doesn't really sound like the most upbeat of 2 hours invested at the multiplex, but is it up to the award hype? Scott?
No.
Excellent. Drew?
No.
Ridley Scott as a director.
No, it merits a little more than that, right? It's probably a worthy enough film. I mean, it's well enough acted and it's dramatically sound and all that. The problem I've got with it is that it's one of, well, apart from, it's one of these based on a true story films that's substantially more based on than true story. And when you actually get to the nuts and bolts of what's going on in the film, I really just don't understand what it's trying to say, because the police corruption that's featured in here, okay, there's parts of it that are sensible in that sort of sense, and that the police are sort of killing off criminals and essentially setting up their own racket, and that's understandable. I can see why that is corruption that would benefit someone. What they also seem to be doing is returning the wrong child to someone, then everyone's swearing blind that it is the right kid, and then when the mother complains, having them put into mental facilities, which I can't really see the point of. And I just
can't see what the police are gaining from it, no.
No, I just the whole film is based on something that just doesn't make a lick of sense.
You can seem to consider the potential murder of 20 children an inconvenience as opposed to a heinous crime which must be investigated. It's just, it's very odd.
And this is before there were Dunkin' Donuts to distract policemen. What were they doing then?
It's just because it is so strange and bizarre what's going on. I can't really get behind the whole plight and the emotional turmoil that the mother should be going through. Mm. Because it's just daft. I spent most of the time going, like, why is this happening and what's going on?
So perhaps in this case then, the sort of its basis in fact, which apparently it's adhered to quite well, perhaps it doesn't benefit it so much then.
I mean, I don't study it too much, but I went to the website where it says, like, look at the original LA Times clippings of this event, and I did, and it seemed to be describing a completely different set of events than what actually showed up on the screen, so...
That's a bit cheeky, because apparently the first cut of the film, Clint Eastwood had the title card say, a true story, as opposed to based on a true story. What are you up to, Eastwood? What are you up to, you sly git?
Don't really know if to say one way or the other, but it's certainly, even if it's a true story, it's certainly not a very interesting story at the end of the day, and that's probably all that I can really say about it. Although it did win some points, again, for the acting performance from Jolie and John Malkovich's shouty priest, which is quite good as well. And it also has an angry demonstrating mob carrying placards written such as "Boo to the LAPD," which I thought was endearingly polite for a demonstration.
Yeah. You had a better class of protest in the 20s, really, didn't you? Drew, who would win out of a fight between Dirty Harry and Frank Martin?
Oh, Dirty Harry, clearly.
Well, there you go then. Changeling can't be all that bad. Did you have anything to add?
Yeah, it's probably reasonably well acted. I mean, Angelina Jolie's been talked up for various awards, and I'm thinking, no, it was just sort of, it was adequate. There was nothing particularly special about the performance, so it wasn't in any way bad, though.
To be honest, I'd say I can't really think of too many female lead performances that would be better than it, that would be eligible for Oscars, but...
Well, no, but that's, again, probably there's not that many around just now. It's more just like, yeah, she was reasonable. I didn't invest any particular emotion in her character.
Helen and again, I spent most of this year, has she? So Julie will probably win.
I spent most of my time thinking, similar to Scott, like, why is this happening? And then sort of feeling outraged that a police officer would somehow have the power to put somebody in a mental institution. How is that possible? So again, I spent most of my time thinking, if this is actually true, how was that allowed? Rather than, I wonder what's going to happen next in this film.
Yeah, they do seem to have powers that are more in line with a sort of tin pot dictatorship rather than a police force, don't they?
This is a law which used to exist in the state of California, which gave police officers that right, basically, yeah.
Which is quite frightening, actually.
It certainly is. That's perhaps the most scary thing about the film. But there you go. I haven't seen it, so I can't comment. Ridley Scott is a director who knows that drama and intrigue are best lit harshly from below and edited to within a nanometer of their fragile lives.
So what does Tony Scott do then?
He does the same thing with twice as many bulbs and five times as many editors. So it is that Body of Lies will undoubtedly blow shit up frantically in glorious Technicolor, occasionally pausing to tell the tale of a CIA field agent operating out of Jordan and his handler who operates out of a cushy house in suburban USA. Said field agent would here be played by Leo DiCaprio and his handler by self-modelled anti-establishment Antipodean Russell Crowe, protagonist to a beaten photographer, guitarist to a noisy rock band, and who will have his macho fist fight in this bar or the next. often accused of verging on or crashing through the barrier marked style over substance, Scott does seem to have the knack of pleasing the mass market in a way that doesn't entirely alienate the press, but what can be said of this latest tale of Middle Eastern espionage? Drew, Body of Lies has been receiving mixed reviews from the critics. What say ye, sir?
I can't actually remember much about it.
Well, Scott, what say ye, sir?
Which does speak volumes. It is not the most memorable film in the world. I mean, I'm actually told that, well, Ridley Scott himself tells me, not me, it was an interview in the BBC, but you know, I heard that he's been looking at the Iraq situation before in Kingdom of Heaven, which I thought was a fairly tenuous claim at best.
Well, there are sand in both of them, so don't start.
That would seem to be about the limit of it, but this deals with it a little more head-on in that it's based on the fallout of the current American situation, and well, I suppose we're involved as well in the Iraq and how it's played out in the Middle East. Now, the problem that it has is that the actual tale where Roger Ferris, Leonardo DiCaprio's character, is chasing after this Bin Laden analogue replacement called Al Salim. It's just not massively interesting. It does seem to be hampered mainly by the fact that his supervisor, the Ed Hoffman character, Russell Crowe's character, just seems to be a complete berk and ham-fists pretty much everything in a bid to do whatever the hell it is he's doing. In terms of the way the actual chase goes from the story, it just doesn't seem to work. It's never particularly interesting. There's not an awful lot going on in it. And there's a love interest that seems very much tacked on just to allow the ending to happen. DiCaprio's also on comedy accent duty, which doesn't go too well. It's strange. The one thing that annoyed me more about this, and it was from the same interview with Ridley Scott, is that he seemed very proud that he didn't show the Ed Hoffman character being at a desk at any point, because he was saying that, well, surely spies, they'll be out more, they'll be doing more, they'll be more active and all this sort of thing. And that's fine if you're a field agent. Ed Hoffman isn't. He should be at a desk, because that's what he does. It's his job. He should be driving the desk. I mean, he's the section chief. He should be doing the paperwork for it and all that sort of thing. So yes,
he should be cooking along with Gordon Ramsay while he talks to Leo down the phone.
Yeah, why is he even doing anything that interesting? He's largely out and about picking up his kids from school.
Yeah,
sitting in his back garden.
It seems a crudely forced way to get these little... we look at the juxtaposition where, you know, he's helping his kids to go to the toilet and he's also having a conversation on the Bluetooth headset that's going to change Middle East policy and all that sort of thing. And when the first time it happens, okay, that's sort of cute, but then it keeps happening again when he's, you know, in the back garden having his tea, and it happens again when he's picking his kid up from the soccer match and all this other nonsense. It just seems to like he's never actually in the office. He just seems like a skiver than anyone else. It's not the sort of job you can do by telecommuting.
Well, the thing, Ridley Scott in a recent interview I listened to had said how, oh, you know, the film's basically a comment on how detached these people are, you know, in the Pentagon and places like that from the action that's actually happening on the ground. I don't think you need to show Leo DiCaprio's handler shopping at Sainsbury's to highlight that fact when the other guy's running about a desert being shot at. I think there's enough of a contrast there to begin with. You know, I think we can all understand that. So it seemed odd to me that he would choose to sort of, you know, oh, look, here he is, here he is scuba diving whilst talking to Leo DiCaprio. Here he is feeding some sharks while talking to Leo DiCaprio. I don't know. He's taking bloody art class whilst talking to Leo DiCaprio.
The only thing I can really say I liked about it is it does take a somewhat pleasingly ambivalent stance to the point of how you go about extracting information from people and all that sort of thing. It's not quite the same as these sort of movies like Rendition, which just sort of beats you over the head for 90 minutes going, torture is bad, okay? And it takes a little bit more nuance to it. What else did I like in it? I think the chief of Jordanian security, Hani, is played by Mark Strong, and I think he's the only character that actually comes out of it who seems like competent and is actually any good at it at all.
Yeah, but there's a problem too, though. I would have to fail this entire film under resoundingly mediocre, and because I'd agree that it's probably the most interesting character and the one that seems to be the most worthy of your respect. But at the same point, all I could think of is, why Mark Strong? Why yet another dodgy wig? Was that your idea or the director's? That's terrible. After having followed up a particularly dodgy wig in Rock and Roller, and it kind of tells you that it wasn't that interesting a film, that's what was occupying my thoughts at the time.
But if you like bad wigs, it's a great movie. Other than that, I'd probably give it a body swerve. It's just not very interesting.
Fantastic. Clark Gregg may be recognisable to some as the West Wing's FBI agent Michael Casper, but his first move behind the camera will undoubtedly go unnoticed by many. He's chosen to direct an adaptation of Chuck Palahniuk's novel Choke, the tale of a sex-addicted fraudster whose mother's healthcare balance is met by pretending to choke in restaurants and preying on the kind souls who heimlich him out of danger. It's certainly not as marketable as the basic premise of Palahniuk's most high-profile work Fight Club, but while Maverick David Fincher expertly moulded that novel into both a dark satire on modern masculinity and a crowd-pleasing festival of face-mashing, it seems Greg's work is most definitely cut out for him. But tell me, please, guys, that our last film this week is a good one.
It's really, really good. I suspect it will follow the path of many films that will become one of these undiscovered gems on DVDs that people will sort of stumble across at one point in their life and then rave about for some years afterwards. So I suspect it will actually just vanish in the cinema, but it's really quite good. It follows... It follows very similar concepts to Fight Club, actually. So if you did like Fight Club, I'm fairly sure you'd actually go on to like Choke. Sam Rockwell, who's the lead character, Victor Mancini, plays an absolute blinder. He's rarely bad in anything, and he's often very, very good. And here he is, very, very good again. I mean, I suppose the flavour to it comes from the fact that not only is he doing this the whole choking business you described earlier, he's also a sex addict, because you can't have just one bad flaw in a character in a Palahniuk novel. That, however, is essentially a lead-in to a tale of this character study of a person who's had to push people away for his whole life, so he basically is always looking for people to try and actually get close to him, and that's where the sex addiction comes from. And it deals a lot with his relationship with his mother, who is sectioned in a mental hospital, who has various issues, and you're shown in flashback to Victor's childhood, where the cause of many of his neuroses is quite clearly evident, as her mother would take him away from his foster parents and drag him across town on various madcap adventures. And the mother, of course, played by Angelica Houston, who also plays an absolute blinder. It is very sharply observed. It's very, very funny. Again, not one for those who choose to be offended by everything, but again, if you're the sort of person that liked Fight Club, then you're the kind of person that's going to think that the majority of this film is absolutely hilarious. It is somewhat to the left of field. It does have some pretense at actually trying to teach us something. It seems to have some sort of philosophical basis that it's trying to force upon you, which is perhaps the least of the film, because it's not actually particularly insightful in the best of times, and actually taking something that is this oddball seriously is always going to be a difficult ask. That's a very small element of the thing, though. The rest of it is just a very enjoyable film that I heartily recommend to anyone.
It's just a film that had me grinning and just very, very pleased that I'd seen it, and certainly something I'll watch again, and that's all I can say. It was funny, it was good.
It's worth seeing just for Sam Rockwell's miserable day job at this historical American theme park, where everyone's in character, and the actual director himself is playing the
Lord High Charlie
or something of it, who's hilariously pompous, and he plays a very good asshole. Yeah, so it's just very funny all the way throughout, and I've very, very much enjoyed it.
Fair play. Pop quiz. Who put the bomb in the bomb bomb diddle eye bomb?
Was it Osama bin Laden?
No, it was Ben.
Was it you?
Scott. No, it wasn't me. I put the Prospect Pally in World of Warcraft. Well, that's it for another informative podcast. Hopefully we've warded you off a pile of shite and cottoned you on to a hidden gem this week. Thanks for listening, as always. We'll be back as soon as we possibly can. But until then, I'm Craig Eastman, and Scott Morris was Scott Morris.
Goodbye.
And Drew Tavendale was a strange man hiding out in Ed Gein's conservatory. Say bye-bye, you mad mass murderer.
Adieu.
Be gone with you all. We are off to be edited. Bye-bye. Oh, dear. What a prospect pally.
Are you using the what now?
This just felt like calling Drew a prospect pally. Woot pally! It's certainly not a prospect pally. Drew, have you come across any prospect pallies lately?
No. Yes. What?
Sorry, I'm just testing it out.